The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome to Film Weekly, I'm Jason Solomons. Yes, it's hard to believe that another year in the cinematic calendar has rolled on, and we're now staring at the Olympic year of 2012. Well, speaking of Herculean tasks, it's that time of the year when Guardian film critic Zam Brooks and I put our pens to paper, our quills to vellum, our fingers to keyboard, and write down our top 10 films of the year. Yes, it's the Film Weekly Top 10 Countdown Special. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, hope you've enjoyed yourselves, looking forward to the new year, but first we shall look back over the old year, 2011. Zan, was it a vintage year for cinema?
Yes it was, I can answer that unequivocally. Normally it's hard coming up with 10 top films. This year was particularly fiendishly difficult, I thought. I mean, weirdly I almost could have had a completely alternative top 10 that I'd have been quite happy
like in that to movie, Another Earth.
Yeah, and they're, exactly they're like Another Earth. Another Earth wouldn't have made it into either
no,
top 10.
That's true.
But, you know, it could have been so different.
Yeah.
To
I
how
mean,
it is.
One of the things that seems to me that when you look back over the year is that it was a very strong Cannes.
Yes, it
which
was.
Which people
yeah.
were, you know, were worried about how's that going to shape a very strong Cannes. And then a very strong Venice
yeah.
as well, which then, you know, that shows basically what, you know, the quality sustained throughout the year. And I'm sifting through trying to get a top 10. And I've had to go to like 26 before I could even,
yeah.
you know, go, you know, get. And, you know, half of those could be in the top 10. So in the end, it's going to be very interesting where, you know, where we've actually gone for.
Yeah. And I'm already mourning and pining for the ones that didn't make the cut.
Do you feel you go, well, that's not going to make it? You think,
it's
oh,
like
no.
Sophie's Choice. Like,
yeah, and you want people to see the ones that you think, oh,
yeah.
that's nice. But, you know, there's 3-star, 4-star, 5-star pictures. You've got to go for the stars in the end. So,
yeah.
Well, let's find out where we've gone, Zan. We'll do it in our usual fashion where, you know, we trade one another. We kind of go mano a mano.
Yeah.
Like,
and if one of us has a film further up the list, we then defer the conversation.
Yeah, we'll wait till
okay.
that. We discuss that
okay.
and play a clip of it later. So we're a bit like Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton in Warrior.
In Warrior, is
yeah.
that on the list?
Tops off.
I'm trying to kind of get you to spill some
I give nothing away. This is that weigh-in bit where we just stare each other out. No, I don't think Warrior's made it. It's a tough year if Warrior has made it, although I did quite like it. You're the Nick Nolte character, if anyone.
Yeah, I'm a broken-down old pug.
Number 10, we're going to start with my number 10, which is actually a film that is a hangover from Venice 2010, a film
yeah.
I first saw there, and has stayed with me ever since, and then I saw it again this year. It is a South American film. It is Postmortem.
Do you know? That's my number 10 as
no,
well.
No, it's not.
It is.
Number 10, you've
yeah,
got 10.
That's my number 10.
Both,
we are absolutely in synchronicity.
That's ridiculous because it's my obscure choice kind of thing. Pablo Larraín's Postmortem.
Yes, I know exactly the one you mean because it's my number 10.
Well,
and I think I probably wrote that first.
No, I was straight in with Postmortem.
Let's hope that we do differ on some of these things. Otherwise, this is going to be the most lockstep
and
podcast
then, and then
ever.
It's that thing where yeah, critics do get together and create a consensus of opinion because we've been doing this too long that we now actually, even
but
though we disagree
done,
regularly.
This, we do, and this was done completely sight unseen. But
okay.
Both of our top 10, our number 10 is Postmortem.
Postmortem.
Cadáver de sexo masculino identificado como Salvador Allende Gossens.
¿Por qué? Este hombre estaba aquí.
So we heard a bit there from Postmortem. Tell people, for people who aren't us, who haven't seen this film, of which there are probably many, tell them about it.
It's a rumble-tumble bromance about about two frat
critics.
Boys. no, it's not. It's Pablo Larraín who did a film called Tony Manero a couple of years ago that was also, I think, also in my top 10.
Yeah, but that was in
two
your
years
top 10,
ago,
yeah.
which was a superb film. It's the same actor, Alfredo Castro, and the same backdrop, which is Pinochet-era Chile. And Alfredo Castro plays Mario, who's a pathologist at the morgue. And it seems at times that the only difference between him and the corpses is that he's sort of upright and,
yeah.
and walking
he's
around
the same
a bit.
Colour as him, isn't
he's
he?
The same colour, and he's got the hair that's sort of grown out, maybe in the nails, the long yellow nails. He chases very forlornly after an aging showgirl neighbour. He has to file a suicide report under the watchful eye of the Pinochet regime. And it's a film that's just steeped in evil and the sort of the bureaucratic compromises of evil.
Yeah, that's why it's an atmosphere film for me. I did like Tony Manero very much as well, which was a very dark comedy in some kind of way. But this was about a little man caught up in a bureaucracy of a dictatorship as well, and being powerless to intervene in some kind of way. I loved that kind of, it was all going on outside the windows of the morgue, and and he's kept counting up the bodies, they're piling them up. There's something very Brechtian, vile, very pirate Jenny as I count up the bodies.
Yeah, it's got the sort of Kafkaesque quality of the bureaucracy, but it's also got this sort of Bulgakov kind of absurdism that's thrown in there. This very sort of pitch black comic sensibility that's never really amped up, but you're just aware of, you know, the body politic basically being on the slab and the weird, absurdist humour around that.
And that's right. I mean, calling it post-mortem, obviously, because he's a pathologist. We're not talking that BBC series Waking the Dead here, where they're kind of going back. But we are looking at a Chilean filmmaker who's addressing those issues in South American cinema, which has obviously having a revival. But it's not always going back into the past as deeply as this filmmaker is.
No, not at all. And it's strange because, you know, Pablo Larraín is young. I think he's sort of early mid-30s. But this is presumably the world that he grew up being aware of and was steeped in.
I think in the interview that I did with him from Venice 2010, which you can go back on your old film weeklies, he said, I think his dad worked for the Pinochet regime in some kind of way, because everyone did in some kind of way, silently.
Yeah. So there's this terrible legacy that understandably a culture actually now would prefer not to address at all. And this does. This goes back into the viscera of it. And it's a disturbing film, but I think he's one of the most talented filmmakers out there at the moment. I'm really looking forward to what he does next.
Yeah, exactly. Well, amazingly, that is both in our top 10. It is our number 10 choice for 2011. It is out on DVD, I believe, so very much worth catching if you follow Zan and me. Our number 9 film, Zan. I'm gonna let you go.
All right, okay. I've got to show my hand first now. Yeah. My number 9 film is Drive by Nicholas Winding Refn.
Hold on, I'm skidding to a halt, Zan. My number 9 film is Drive.
No, you're kidding.
By Nicholas Winding Refn.
This is, one of us is surplus to requirements here. So I just leave.
No, that's just.
I'll just leave, and you just go right through it all.
There's 100,000 streets in this city. You don't need to know the route. You give me a time and a place. I give you a 5-minute window. Anything happens in that 5 minutes and I'm yours. No matter what. Anything happens a minute either side of that and you're on your own. Do you understand?
That is completely bizarre.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's a very good film.
It's a very good film. It's probably the 9th best film of the year.
Yeah, I would say that. Yes, I would tend to agree. It won Best Director for Nicholas.
It won Best Director. It's an existential heist movie. It's got, I guess, the films of Walter Hill, John Carpenter in its rear view mirror. It's a very self-consciously retro film, and yet is directed with such gusto and panache and confidence that it feels like it's, you know, fresh off the production line. It's Ryan Gosling as a Hollywood stunt driver who moonlights as a getaway driver, offering his clients 5 minutes of his time, after which they're on their own. And it's a film in which you have the sense that everybody's kind of on their own.
My free gift of the year this year goes to Drive. We gave them away on the show some driving gloves, some brown leather driving gloves, and I got them in a drawer. And I don't know what to do with them. I don't know what you do with driving gloves.
You've got to do one last heist, I think.
Yeah, but why do you need driving gloves? It's not to keep you warm. Is it not for the wheel? I only mentioned this
it's so you don't get your dabs on the steering wheel.
Ah, that might be it. Because there was much about the realism in this film. Our colleague Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian wrote a kind of long thing about, you know, so I don't get the whole driving, the 5-minute driving thing.
Yeah.
And then someone said, well, it's about that. And he went, And I always thought, you know, it's something we all do. And it was about the minutiae of driving. It's like, well, you can't get a parking space. And it's like, this is a movie. It just doesn't really matter, does it?
Yeah, and also it's LA, where everyone drives and it's car friendly. Yeah. I mean, you know, if he was in London, it would be the most boring, frustrating movie you could imagine.
Absolutely. It is it's shamelessly stylish, and it's also very violent. I do like to warn people ahead of it. They sort of get surprised. But we're talking about Ryan Gosling in that beautiful silver jacket, one of my great items of clothing of the year. But it gets bloodier and bloodier until it is kind of, you know, almost blood red.
It is. And you say it's stylish, and stylishness tends to get used as a sort of pejorative term. Yeah. And yet when it's done this well, it becomes the film itself. It becomes the narrative. It's, you know, the medium is the message. And this is a work of narrative brilliance. I mean, it's a B-movie, basically. And it's playing of all those B-movie archetypes, you know, the one last job, the bag of loot, the nice girl who he wants to protect, but he shouldn't because then he's caught up in this whole kind of maelstrom.
Yeah, Kerry Mulligan, of course.
And all of those things are, they're the kind of mythic archetypes of I guess, low-rent Hollywood. And yet there's something so charged and powerful about them when they're handled this honestly, in this sort of forthright manner.
And I think this is something we both mentioned at the time, that it is about that low rent Hollywood, because it's seen by an outsider, Nicholas Winding Refn, a Dane who's gone to Hollywood and can look at the underbelly somewhat with somewhat more. I don't know. I suppose there's a clear sightedness, but also with somewhat more mythic kind of awe.
Yes, exactly. And also, it's an LA that exists, but you don't normally see this kind of LA, in that the beach is nowhere. Mm. It's overcast, so you've got these gunmetal skies, and it is all strip malls and freeways, and this sense of a great non-space, and a non-space that people are detached from, and that terrible things can happen, but because there's no centre, it's almost like there's no moral centre either, and that captures that brilliantly.
Brilliantly put, Zan. You can listen to Nicholas Winding Refn and I discussing such matters on the show on Film Weekly. Just Google Film Weekly Nicholas Winding Refn, and he'll be on there too. We interview the best on this show, of course. Moving on to our number 8 choice of the year 2011. Zan, is it my turn? It's my turn to lay down my...
Okay, let's try and break with the script.
Okay, at number 8, I am going for Tran and Hung's Norwegian Wood. That's Johnny Greenwood's score, him of Radiohead. I thought making an absolutely beautiful, beautiful movie that had me completely spellbound. I didn't know what was going to go on. It was set in the Japanese unrest of the 1968, when they sort of aped the student riots that were going on in Europe. Then there's a love story about a girl who can't love. It's slightly confusing. She's called Midori. He's in love with two different kind of Japanese girls, both of which are a bit of trouble, to be honest with you. And it's completely confusing. It was a very sensuous experience. He is one of my favourite filmmakers, and I really wanted to like this film, but it stayed with me. It wasn't that popular as a movie, but I thought it looked absolutely and sounded extraordinary.
I have to say, I think we probably came within a whisker of being in absolutely in tandem again. I did a provisional top 10 that Norwegian Wood was on. As it is, it's on my Another Earth top 10. I totally agree, and I'm therefore delighted that this is at least on your list, so it does make it
in. I didn't remember you liking that one so much.
Well, this was the weird thing, that I came out thinking it's so ephemeral, it's like gossamer, that it's just all going to kind of blow away, and it's almost inconsequential. And you're right, it does stay with you. It's got this narcotic, kind of hypnotic power that I did find myself carrying it around. And it's the thing of, you know, it's teenage love and the solipsism and the self-indulgence of that, and yet ennobled and made into something absolutely beautiful. So I thought Norwegian was a wonderful film.
Really sexy as well, and kind of daringly sexy. There's kind of, you know, oral sex. So there's also an amazing scene, which I think most filmmakers would say, scrap it, cut it, let's come back when it's... But it was windy. There was just wind going everywhere. It was more windy than Wuthering Heights in this film. It was about the turbulence. And I remember asking Tran Anung, you know, why didn't you just wait till it was calm? Because Alan Wake, I've hired a helicopter to make that wind. It was all there for a reason. I think he's a supremely skilled filmmaker. So very glad that you agree with me, although you didn't put it at your number 8. What did you go for instead?
My number 8 is a documentary. It's been, you know, every year we say it's been a great year for documentaries. This year I was, you know, could have chosen Senna, I could have chosen Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I could have chosen Pina 3D. Yes. But in the end I went with Project Nim by James Marsh.
You have to kind of understand chimps to be able to understand how to work with them and be with them. I took them out on walks. I didn't bring food. I didn't do the kind of things that would interrupt the relationship or the building of the relationship.
This, I suppose, is a Pygmalion tale, in a way. It's the monkey as Pygmalion experiment. It's about a primate specialist called Herb Terence, who in the early 1970s tried to raise a chimp called Nim as a human, teaching him sign language. But really, I suppose it's a story of how dysfunctional adults took a presumably entirely functional chimp and totally screwed him up.
Yeah, I mean, what's fascinating about this film. I really enjoyed the film as well, and I do think it's a great story there. And that James Marsh is a great sort of filmmaker. I'm not sure that I knew quite what this film was about, and I'm not sure. Maybe it's because there is no definitive.
Well, that's an issue that I sort of grappled with as well. That it's almost like raw matter. And at times you think, I wish he'd sculpted this into a more of a thesis, but actually it's all there. It's all there. And it's this horrible car crash, this slow motion car crash. If you've got the posh bohemian mom of the chimp who's happily confessing to breastfeeding the little chimp, but also sleeping with the scientist who brings the chimp over because they're all just, you know, one big happy family.
Seventies,
even though she's married with kids and things like that. Then it trails him from refuge to refuge and finally to the vivisection lab. And it has this awful, horrific momentum, this film.
James Marsh can be a cold-hearted filmmaker. I mean, I think in Man on Wire, which he did previous to this, another sort of exploration of 70s Manhattan mythology, what he did was dramatically reconstruct the bits that were missing. So maybe we were expecting that from him.
I preferred this to Man on Wire.
It's much more forensic.
It's much more forensic, and it's a great bit of social anthropology, and it's a film that maybe you do want more of a guiding hand through it, but it's a film that asks questions and forces you to work out what was the right thing to do at this point. What is our responsibility to the people around us and to this poor animal at the centre of it?
Exactly. There's a Caliban element to it as well. Yeah. What have we taught him?
The chimp is growing, and he's growing more confused, and he's growing more vicious.
One of the stories of the year was that this came out in the same week as a sort of blockbuster about the same sort of thing.
Rise, which was very good.
An excellent one that nearly made my top 10, isn't it? It's sort of bubbling under. Yeah. I loved it as blockbusters go. And its central thesis was this chimp being then taken to a lab and growing up in James Franco's attic.
Yeah.
And it really was like a sort of some knuckle-scraping cousin to this documentary.
Yeah. I thought that this was a fantastic film.
Yeah, good choice at number eight, Project Nim.
Okay, Jason, moving on. What's your number seven film of 2011?
My number seven film for 2011, Zan, is a film that came out at the beginning of the year. So it's one of those ones that stretches all the way back. It's Animal Kingdom. A debut film by an Australian filmmaker I'd never heard of called David Michaud, which then got surprise Oscar for one of the performances of the year by a woman called Jackie Weaver, a veteran of that new wave.
It's
of
the
70s.
Sort of harpy matriarch.
Yeah,
it was
a film that, again, is one that lives on, and I found myself thinking again this year when another excellent film called Snowtown came out from Australia, and it reminded me of this kind of lurking suburban crime scene in Australia. We're talking about a family here who kind of co-opt one of their youngsters into the family crime unit and try and bamboozle the police, excellently played by Guy Pearce. Some of the performances in this are extraordinary. Ben Mendelsohn as the kind of lead guy of Animal Kingdom, one of the finest gangster films that I can remember.
Everything knows its place in the scheme of things. Everything sits in the order somewhere. Things survive because they're strong, and everything reaches an understanding. You may think that because of the circles that you move in, or whatever, that you're one of the strong creatures. But you're not. You're one of the weak ones. There's nothing against you. You're just weak because you're young.
So I thought that was a blistering debut from David Michaud. I don't know what he's going to do next or where it's going to come from. But as I said, that Aussie legacy continued this year in Snowtown.
Yeah, almost. I considered both Snowtown and Animal Kingdom, and it was almost like that weird thing of splitting the ticket, that the votes split and neither of them made it. They're both, I'd be hard-pressed to choose which one was better.
Yeah, it is hard. They're very atmospheric.
They're very atmospheric, and there's this great sense of these suburban crime dramas that we're seeing coming out of Australia, where it is, you know, the big sky, the wide road, and these little houses set back that become these cauldrons of, you know, I keep saying dysfunction. There was dysfunction in Nim.
It is, but it's certainly here. What I liked about this one, we've had films like Chopper in the past and Nick Kelly, but kind of a little more as colourful heroes. These ones are kind of more pathological, depressed
heroes.
It's
the banality of everyday evil, isn't it?
That's my number seven, Animal Kingdoms. And so, what's yours?
My number seven is very, very different than Animal Kingdom. Although it does have animals in it. It's called Le Quattro Volte, and it's by director Michelangelo Framartino.
È un animale, in quanto dotato di conoscenza del mondo esterno, di immaginazione e di memoria.
It certainly sounds like an Animal Kingdom, as you said. You're bleating and tweeting at your way to number seven.
Yeah, well, you know, you need a bit of bleating and tweeting, I think, because it's all the stuff of life. And this is a film expressly concerned with the stuff of life, that it's apparently the Pythagorean theory of the four turns of the soul, which goes from human to animal to vegetable to mineral. Mm. This makes it sound like horribly heavyweight.
I never got this film.
You didn't, did you? I remember.
It was one of my
saying.
Big misses of the year. The Quattro Volte. I vaulted right over this film.
I loved this. You know that The Lion King. It's the Hakuna Matata. It's the circle of life. Just because they're not singing it, you didn't like it.
I didn't know. So we're set in a hilltop.
Yeah, it's set
town.
In Calabria in southern Italy, and it's about an old goat herd. Who has a cough, and he treats himself by making a potion from the dust swept from the church.
Did he do a big poo in the soil or something?
That's in the director's cut.
Okay.
I thought this was wonderful.
And I mean, many people were enchanted.
It's moving, it's funny, it's got a fantastic 8-minute sequence with a dog. The shepherd's dog, the rolling truck, the goats escaping.
Yeah, I'm so against animals.
It's great. I mean, it's light as air, and yet it's wonderfully profound. And I think it's a film. You know, maybe it's because in the course of our working weeks, we end up sort of going to blockbuster after blockbuster to see a film that completely throws out the rule book and conjures something magical out of, I guess, thin air and the stuff of life and the rhythms of nature. I thought this was an absolute tonic.
Yeah, you're quite in touch with that sort of stuff.
I am, I'm a child of the soil.
You know, as I say, it completely escaped me, and I felt it was one of those, my not even guilty pleasures, it was one of my guiltinesses of the year. I just did not go with anyone who would, and it was in Cannes the year before.
Yes, it was,
It was a sleeper hit there, surprising people in Critics Week, and I was like, oh, you've got to see the goat movie, and I was bleating on at the time about how rubbish Cannes was that year. And everyone said, oh, but you didn't see the goat movie.
And then you saw the goat
movie. I would have made it even
movie.
Bloody worse had I seen the goat movie, to be honest with you. I would butt out at number seven.
Okay, well, I'm glad that we're you know, going off in different courses.
Getting
now.
To grips. I wonder how we'll get on at number six, Zan. I will ask you for your number six choice of 2011.
My number six choice is a film that I suspect almost didn't make it anywhere at all. It's a film called Margaret by the American writer-director Kenneth Lonergan.
Do you remember me from the bus accident?
It's a tragedy. You cannot bring her back.
I'm talking about telling the accident investigators what really happened.
But you already talked to them.
I know that, but I lied.
You're going to go home, and you're going to do your homework, and I'm going to lose my job. And who's going to take care of my family? You?
Anna Paquin in that film, she, I'm delighted to say, was nominated in the Critics Circle nominations in Best Actress. This is a film, really, that you're doing the service to here. It's a film that's been rescued by critics. It's one of the stories
one
of the
year. One of maybe the very few times that critics make a damn bit of difference, apart from that one in Ratatouille a couple of years
ago. Anton Ego.
Yes, exactly. This was a film that actually, by rights, we probably should have seen about 5 years ago. It was Lonergan's follow-up to You Can Count on Me, which was another terrific film that I think is now 11 years old, mired in, I think, an ongoing legal dispute with Fox that backed it. Initially came in as a three-hour cut that's had to be whittled down to 2.5 hours. Occasionally it shows. Occasionally you can see the scissor marks, but that actually only adds to its sort of jagged, caffeinated air. It's a sort of teeming, turbulent drama of I guess, post-9/11 unease.
It's a New York film.
It's a New York film. It's the Upper West Side. It's Anna Paquin as Lisa, who's this sort of sport brat 17-year-old who indirectly causes a fatal bus accident and then is mired in a legal action herself against the bus driver played by Mark Ruffalo.
So what is it about this film that has appealed to critics? I mean, many people have seen it, been enchanted by it, saying, oh, you know, this, I know it's a folly and it kind of doesn't quite work. And so for something imperfect, it's made a lot of people's end of year top 10. It's made people are really kind of championing this film. What's the substance of it? Why see it if it's a bit of a mess?
I would dispute that it's a folly. I don't think it's a folly at all. I don't think that there's anything even indulgent about it. I think that it's, it's like sort of Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities.
Right.
It's this sort of sprawling overview, colourful social history of this little bit of New York and all of the angst and the games people play and the fact that this character Lisa spins this drama into our own redemptive saga, and it's about the roles that we write for ourselves and that impact on
others. So it's
more
in an intelligent New York.
Yeah, it's
here.
Really, it's smart as hell, and it's bourgeois as hell. A great performance from Lonergan's wife, Jay Smith Cameron, as Lisa's sort of Broadway diva mum, Matt Damon, and Matthew Broderick as teachers, and just a superb performance from Paquin as well. There's always a sort of sentimental thing of the little broken bird, the film that sort of didn't quite make it, and let's nurse it.
Yeah.
Forget that. It stands up. And yes, it feels a little bit hacked around, but I think it goes down as a mutilated masterpiece, like Magnificent Ambersons, say, or Red Badge of Courage. They've been dipped around with, but they're still towering works of art.
Who's Margaret?
Margaret doesn't appear. Margaret is a line from a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem that Matthew Broderick quotes. But,
right.
But Margaret's
just
not there.
So that's what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with the absent Margaret.
That's Margaret, which I think you made a very good case for being in your list. I've got to confess, I missed it. I thought I don't know what this is, and now it's being totally rescued, and I'm going to have to go and see it.
You will. You were prejudiced just because it was called Margaret.
I wasn't. She wasn't in it. I looked down the cast list. I can't see anyone playing Margaret. I'm going to see that. It's ridiculous. But interesting enough, at my number six, Zan is an example of American cinema in much the same vein. It's a film that was seen by very few people, played only at the ICA here in the UK, and it's called Putty Hill.
How old are you?
22.
What do you do for work?
Self-employed.
How do you mean?
It means I work for myself.
This is a Baltimore movie directed by Matthew Porterfield. And for me, it was the American indie movie of the year. I mean, I don't think it's been a fantastic year for American independent cinema.
Probably hasn't.
Looking not great at our list. I mean, Drive, I suppose, is an American indie movie, but very much in the European vein. And for me, Putty Hill showed stirrings of art cinema happening, set in Baltimore about a funeral occasion, people coming together for the funeral of a woman and all coming back to Baltimore. Baltimore's had a bit of a bad press, I think, recently.
Or The Wire.
Things like The Wire, exactly. I mean, suppose John Waters' Hairspray.
Yeah, we've got the Anne Tyler novels often set in Baltimore.
Yeah, there's something odd about Baltimore.
Well, it's neither north nor south, is it? So
yeah.
It's where the join is and where the friction is. It's like the kind of San Andreas Fault of the Mason-Dixon line.
And it's
line,
also quite a divided city into black and white. I think it's still got a lot of old prejudice lines on it. And I thought Putty Hill captured all of this brilliantly. It had that listlessness of youth. It was a slightly Gus Van Sant-ish in a way, but where Gus Van Sant-ish, he gave us a film like Restless.
Which is one of the worst films of the
wasn't
year.
It? Just all useless, we were calling it. Putty Hill really kind of took that and showed what could be done with it. It had my favourite scene of the year, I think, in which a man was giving tattoos by the light of this pen, this tattoos. Was lighting up, almost like a Goya kind of inside. It was, I thought, a brilliant film. I showed it to my brother because I got it on disc, and he sort of said, "Oh, it was brilliant for about an hour, and then nothing happened. And you've given me a film in which nothing happened." And I don't think that's true. It had a great funeral scene. It had a great kind of bit like in Paddy Considine's Tyrannosaur, where they all sort of sat around and kind of did a hoedown. That's what it had in Putty Hill.
I haven't seen Putty Hill. I heard good things about it, but I haven't seen
it. So. At our number six is bizarre. Joseph feels that neither.
Yeah.
Lucky we didn't agree on both Judy
films.
Then we'd
have been caught out.
Oh, damn, red-handed. We're halfway through the film choices of the Film Weekly crew from 2011. At number five, I wonder where our sensibilities will meet. Zan, I'm going for my number five, and I'm going for the return of one of the great maestros of British filmmaking. Terence Davis was back with The Deep Blue Sea.
Ready, darling. Would you come home with me, please? No, I will not. You'll start talking and pleading.
No. I won't. I promise I won't. I swear I won't try to make you stay.
Rachel Weisz as Hester, begging Freddie to come home with her even though it's over. One of the British actors who had a great year this year, Tom Hiddleston. Yeah. And I think Rachel Weisz has never been better than as Hester in The Deep Blue Sea. It's one of those films that just grabbed me and got me. I blubbed. It worked for me. The complete artistry of Terence Davis, even though it's a very particular kind of look at me artistry in its own way.
I think it is. It's a very formal and precise kind of artistry. It plays out largely in cheap rooming houses in Islington and pubs that are, you can barely see anyone because of the haze of cigarette smoke. And it is that amazing evocation of post-war Britain and just the stultifying nature of it. And as Rachel Weisz's character said, Hester says, they can't ration everything. So it's love as this, or not even love, passion as this liberating thing. But of course, there's no escape, because where the hell can these people go?
This destructive thing. I mean, she wants this kind of one last thing, because she's married to Simon Russell Beale, who's slightly, actually very good. I liked him as a kind of bumbling judge.
Entirely sympathetic character.
Yeah, except his mother is
his mother is the monster, isn't she? Yeah. And she says, beware of passion, Hester. It always leads to something nasty.
It's a sort of film that, where the silences are kind of punctuated by the clutter of silver spoons on china or the crackle of a fire, or the curtains being drawn. I love the atmosphere. Yes, I know he kind of nails post-war Britain. I wasn't there, so I don't really know. What he does for me is kind of create a kind of nostalgia. The very act of memory is what he kind of summons up here. And it's about a woman mired in her time and constricted by almost by the cinema screen itself. I found this profoundly affecting film, and I didn't think it was going to work for me, but the whole kind of combination of Barber violin concerto plus Joe Stafford singing her song at the end.
The violin concerto, all of that slightly annoyed me. It felt like a sort of Plague of Locusts had got loose.
Well, that's what I mean. It's very stylized, and I think you can either kind of come out of it or kind of go, and all the pub sing-alongs that are there, you know, even featuring Sight and Sound editor Nick James in a cameo role as in singing the pubs. All of that, it's very Terence Davis, I have to say. It just got me, mainly because I think that Rachel Weisz was superb in it, really. I think it was one of the performances of the year, slightly being overlooked, I think, in the awards categories.
She is very good in it. All three protagonists are very good. I found it stagey, but I think that's almost by its nature. It's stagey. I mean, obviously, it's a Terence Rattigan play, but it's a play about people being trapped in little rooms, isn't it?
A bit of a sucker. Sometimes one goes for one's favourites. I am genuinely, every time I return to one of these top tens, I'm a sucker for unrequited love. And even though the love is requited in this, it's not satisfied in its own kind of way.
It's consummated on everything but the loving level.
You know what? I mean, one of my favourite films of all time is In the Mood for Love. Mm. And this sort of had that nostalgic feel and that kind of imprisonment that Wong Kar-wai does in Hong Kong.
It does have that, and it has a great final scene between Tom Hiddleston and Rachel Weisz where you actually think they have met, they have connected. It might not be working out, but there is a depth of feeling here.
So I've gone for it in my top five, which I'm very pleased. Zan, best of British to you. Zan, what's your number five?
My number five is, weirdly, another film that plays out in a exhausted, knackered London. It's Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy.
Ah, now, Zan, I'm a fan of Tinker Tailor as well.
Even more a fan than
more me. More than number five, in fact. So we'll
defer.
Talk about it. So we'll talk about it a bit later when it pops up on my list.
Let's
will
that
be? But that is odd that you've gone for that kind of British feel right in the middle, in the midsection as well. We've kind of both returned to our kind of, you know, squalid period drama British roots. But I think both with very refreshing twists on that theme. So that's fascinating. I think it's time now to have a look at some of our listeners who've been faithful throughout the year as ever. They've been tweeting and emailing in with some of their choices, their top threes of the years. I've got one from Pixie Glass here, or Claire Vaughan. She's tweeted in, my top films of 2011, we need to talk about Kevin, Incendies, and Melancholia. I don't know if that's 1, 2, 3 or 3, 2, 1. So I don't know where she is.
Either way, that's not bad at all.
Yeah, kind of good choices there, Pixie Glass. What have you got?
What have I got? I've got Louise K. Phillips. That's Louise K. Phillips to you. Her top three, another good, very good. Drive, The Troll Hunter, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Well, that's a good mix.
That's a good mix, yeah.
As well, that was that Norwegian CGI.
A lot of love for Drive here.
Yeah, a lot of Scandinavian love there. Hold on, what's she gone for? She's gone for Drive, Toronto, and Tinker Tailor. Yeah. All Scandinavian directed.
Yeah. I wonder if she's being paid by the Scandinavian Tourist Board.
Yeah, I think so. I've got one from Keith Farmer here, who goes by the name of Zettel23. He's gone... he's tweeted at Film Weekly and at Picture Houses, making sure he's in with a shout at the competition winning there, because the prize is a year's membership to a picture house near you. The Well Digger's Daughter... the Daniel O'Tay film. A few people even saw that film, but I rather liked it, as you did too. Never Let Me Go. There's a memory from last February. Kira Knightley, rather affecting film. And Tyrannosaur. He's gone for Paddy Considine's very explosive debut, which isn't. I don't want to ruin him. It's not on. It's on my bubbling under list.
Yeah, me too.
And I sort of now feel like, why isn't it on my list?
I know, this is
should
it.
I put that in.
A quick tweet from Canadian Turtle, a.k.a. Zarina.
We have listeners everywhere.
And Canadian Turtle goes for The Artist, Tangled, and The King's Speech. I'm glad to see Tangled getting a mention, because I really enjoyed Tangled. I have a small daughter, so I've watched Tangled more times than I normally would have done. But I'm very grateful to her, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have seen it.
Well, I feel the same about Arthur Christmas, which we've got on the screen. I very much enjoyed it, and my son does too as well. So I feel I might be kind of making a Christmas tree for my own back here and having to watch that in perpetuity. But there are worse things to watch in perpetuity. Finally, Anna Brett, or Cardiff Cymru. She is probably Welsh. I don't know if there's a picture house in Wales. Maybe there is. But her top three were Planet of the Apes, or Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hollows Part 2, which is interesting, isn't it?
Deathly Hollows, is that different from the...
It's a slightly
different from the...
hollowed out version of the Deathly Hallows. I think she meant the Deathly Hallows Part 2. And then The Artist. Interesting with the Harry Potter film, because I know it was one of the stories of the year, Harry Potter finished.
Yeah, wasn't that the best news of the year?
It was for you,
huge relief. Although, I have to say that the last one I did quite like.
Yeah, me too. In fact, it took them eight
films to get me, but they finally
they
did.
They did. I really enjoyed it as well, as I did Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Her number one, or maybe it's her number three, I don't know, is The Artist as well. Perhaps we shall be discussing that a little bit later on. As I say, there were many films of mine that didn't make it. Incendies was one. You mentioned as a documentary. Yeah. I haven't put on that, and I now feel terribly guilty about
Senna didn't make it. A Screaming Man, I really
I
liked.
Screaming Man. I've got it here as number 20 on there. Right. And I absolutely love that film.
Joanna Hogg's Archipelago, I thought was terrific. That didn't make it. Mademoiselle Chambon.
You had a real love for that.
Yeah, that little star-crossed lovers in small town France.
Vincent
I thought that
Landon,
was a beautiful film.
Yes, you really did. You were very good. Well, it was a nice film. And the film that kicked off Cannes, I thought, so well this year, was Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's film, which I enjoyed immensely and enjoyed. It was the first time I've ever been on a Woody Allen poster as a quote, even though people know
with
I support
your arm around Woody.
No, my arm around. Yeah, Alan no, Wilson. I'm not stupid. My arm was around
Marion Cotillard.
Marion Cotillard. You know, I'm no fool. No, but I thought it was playful and delightful. And so to have my quote on that in the Woody Allen font, the classic.
Well, now they'll have to put a quote on it saying, not in my top 10 for the year, Jason Solomons.
But nevertheless, beautiful, charming and clever. Well done, Woody. Carry on. Midnight in Paris, which is getting a little bit of love in the awards season. Screenplay, that's where they end up putting
I thought it was a bit overpraised, really. I mean, I think it's because 15 years of terrible films from him and one that's really kind of nice.
Yeah.
But it was nice and I did enjoy it.
It was playful and charming and funny and clever. Says so on the poster. Dan, we shall return to our top 10 countdown of the films of 2011. We've reached the number 4 point, and I believe it is your turn to reveal your hand.
Okay, my number 4 film of 2011 is The Skin I Live In by Pedro Almodovar. The Skin I Live In by Pedro Almodovar, I guess, is a psychosexual Frankenstein story, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's one of the insane films
of
the year.
Yeah, it is. This completely took me by surprise in Cannes. The first two thirds, I was thinking, I have no idea what on earth is going on, and I don't care because I'm completely hooked.
Do you think that Almodovar, because of the extraordinary brilliance of what has gone before, that we now trust him? I mean, even if you film, as you said, what is happening here? I knew that somehow in Almodovar's hands,
I think
it's
do. It's the Hitchcock effect, isn't it? He has become, you know, it's rare to compare, you know, fat heterosexual Londoner with, you know, gay Madrid flamboyant Almodovar, but there's certainly a kinship there.
He's no skinny.
That's true. It's got a fantastic performance, a brilliantly restrained, icy performance from Antonio Banderas, making his first film with Almodovar in 20 years.
How nice to have him back in Spanish.
He's so good in this. He plays a renegade plastic surgeon who's, you know, it's one of these films, he's haunted by the ghost of his wife that might not even be a ghost. He's unhinged by the rape of his teenage daughter that might not even be a rape. And it's a film that is like a hall of mirrors. You're not quite sure where you're being led. And yet you know that you're being led by a master. And eventually the light breaks in and everything is revealed.
That's right. You say a hall of mirrors. In fact, one of the central conceits is that he looks into this woman, Elena Anaya, who he's building a suit of impregnable skin for.
Yeah.
And she knows he's looking at her, but he's looking at her through the window. And we don't know, as cinema, it's about that voyeurism of cinema itself, a very kind of playful.
Yes, it's about film. That. And it's about how, I guess, identity is a construct and gender is just a costume. And who are we there for? One criticism, and I think I might even be a criticism you made of this film, is that there's something cold about it. And I think that that's largely true. And yet I actually found the ending very, very moving.
Yeah, but you're
the
right.
The last scene is like the dam bursting, and it's very underplayed, but I kind of had a lump in my throat.
No,
in last,
you're right. I did
find
it cold and clinical because it was about a cold clinician in a way. But you're right. And now the more it lives on in you and gets under your skin, The Skin I Live In does have that. Well, it's almost classic Almodovar. It is about costume and kind of the surprise. I mean, it's kind of what he was doing way, way back in his Movida kind of era.
Yes, but with that, where it was about just throwing everything at the wall and this exuberance, this is perfectly crafted, and he has become a master of suspense and narrative. And I thought this was a tremendous film.
It has my favourite household appliance of the year in this film. There's this vacuum cleaner that comes out of the wall and makes it just fits into the wall, and then you pull it out and it goes straight
You're
back.
You're always
in.
Going for the most prosaic detail.
Yeah, I want one of them.
The vacuum cleaner is, you know, that's by the by.
It is slightly by the by, but nevertheless, I like these sort of things. And I'm sure he worked very hard. I bet he's got one of those at his house.
I bet he has a lot of stuff to clean up.
There's a mess on the floor at Almodovar's. But what's my number four choice? That's what we're
asking.
I'm going to go for a film that completely surprised me, and that surprises me that it's at my number four. But it, for me,
is it Big Mama's House?
It's not Big Mama's House, nor is it Love's Kitchen with the Gordon Ramsay cameo. It is Moneyball, starring Brad Pitt.
It's practice.
No.
Yeah, I'm a player, and you got to cut me from the roster.
No.
Go. What do you mean, no?
No.
Part of the job, man.
Well, I'm not going to do this. I think this is stupid. I'm not going to fire anybody, and this is dumb.
They're professional ball players. Just be straight with them. No fluff, just facts. Pete, I gotta let you go. Jack's office will handle the details.
That's it? Really?
Would you rather get a bullet to the head or fired to the chest and bleed to death?
Now, I love me a sports movie, and this was my favourite sports movie of the year. It's about baseball, which seemed to put a lot of people off here, including its distributor, Sony. He sort of did nothing about this film. They sort of put it out. There's Brad Pitt. There's a baseball field. Go and see it if you like that sort of thing. Well, do you know what? I really do like that sort of thing. And it's this is sort of movie that I really like. It is about the cliche of getting the Motley Crue baseball team together. But not only are they kind of limping and kind of all disformed, but all the kind of baseball coaches kind of say, well, none of these guys can make it. And yet Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill together through statistics kind of make it work and just about get it together. And it's about the little team with no money taking on the big boys. And obviously I'm an Arsenal fan, and it's a constant refrain we spout to ourselves at the Emirates Stadium to try and kind of make up the fact that we can't compete with Manchester City financially, or perhaps we're just not that good. I mean, it is about sport and the upset, but it's also about how how you measure success as well, because it's not the cliche.
What you're saying, that's all the cliche. That is every, you know, and I'm a fan of these films too, but that is the cliche of the sporting drama.
No, but normally the cliche of the sporting drama is that top.
But they do all right, don't they?
Well, they do all right. Do they win, though? is it winning? There's a bit that they win. And now it's proved that it doesn't really work as a system. But I love this film because it sort of had everything in it. It was written by Aaron Sorkin at one stage and Steven Zaillian, who I noticed did The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo recently. So it's The Social Network meets Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
And it had that kind of nerdiness. And it had
Bad News Bears.
We had little Bad News Bears in there, the original or the Richard Linklater version. This one, it just got me in the pit of my stomach. And it was great to see Brad Pitt, I thought, kind of dominating the screen as he does. I think he's a really, really fine actor when given his talent. I could see this bored you to tears.
No, I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was way too long and way too steeped in the arcane details of a sport that I have neither knowledge or particular interest in. That was a bit of a stumbling block for me.
I'm very aware in choosing this one that not everyone would care for it in the way that I did. But I just like the way that in sports movies, people can kind of go, I'm hiring you. And like, if you did that here, it'd be like, I don't know if I'm going to move. And I don't know, my contract stipulates I've got to sit another way. Now, in this one, they just, like, the next day, cut. He's in the other office in the Oakland A's and around the baseball. I love that kind of clinical precision that can happen in filmmaking. Moneyball is a kind of a guilty pleasure of mine, but I thought it was a really, really fine.
There's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. If you like it, you like it.
And I did. Moneyball. We're up to number three on our countdown of the films of 2011. So it is my turn to reveal my third choice to you, Zan. And I'm going for a British film, which I was delighted to feature on this programme not very long ago. It's Carol Morley's Dreams of a Life.
You know, reporters always get asked, what's the best story you've ever done, or the strongest story, or the worst story, or whatever. And this is in my, clutch of ones that, you know, you will just remember through a lifetime.
A documentary about a woman found in a flat in a North London shopping centre, having lain there for 3 years with BBC One still on and her Christmas presents wrapped around her on the sofa. She'd decomposed into a skeleton in the meantime. And Carol Morley reconstructs her life, if you like, kind of brings her back as a ghost.
Yes, she does.
Dramatised by Zowie Ashton. This film, again, is one of those ones that's just lived on with me. I saw it at the London Film Festival and it's lived on with me. How did we let this person die? How did she slip literally down the back of a sofa for 3 years without anyone, not the council, not her family, not her friends, knowing she'd gone?
Particularly as she wasn't the cliche of the character that does slip off the face of the earth. She was, you know, reasonably sociable. I mean, reasonably. She kept people at arm's length. She had secrets in the way that most people do.
Yeah, I'm not telling you all everything. Absolutely. I've got a lot going on.
I would
on
not
here,
want
you know? You know
to
I mean?
Know, Jason. Please spare me. And, you know, she wanted to be a singer. She had relationships and gradually just detached herself in the way that again, some people do from your social circle. And yet she can die and for 3 years people aren't properly questioning where she's gone.
Yeah, and I love the such a city detail of life, a London fact of life, that 250,000 people... I think it's a week, went underneath her flat, you know, into Woodbury Shopping City. The footfall is like one of the highest concentrations in retail in this country. And they're all going past as she's steadily decomposing in front of the one show above their heads.
We're all steadily decomposing in front of the one show. you're right, this is London of the lonely crowd. It's London of shut doors, basically.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it's film as mirror, that you can't fail to watch this film and think, who haven't I been in touch with lately, and where are they? Do I actually know where they are? Are they even still my friend if I haven't spoken to them for a year?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, as a Christmas kind of feel, you want to kind of check on the neighbours. This, for me, was... last year, I think I went for The Arbour as my number one film.
This is very similar to it.
Very similar, playing with form and function and a real life here that's lived on by others in the way that Andrea Dunbar's life was lived on kind of, you know, terribly by her daughters in that film by Claire Barnard. This one had that similar kind of British art school feel to it. I thought it was tremendous. tremendously smart film, and I found it tremendously moving. I know our producer, Jason Phipps, didn't think it was arty quite enough.
Well, I would agree with Jason Phipps on that, that I think that with The Arbor, it was a work of great formal experimentation, yeah. Whereas this, it felt done by necessity, because you're dealing with an absence. So you're having to fill those gaps, and you do it through reconstruction and interviewing certain witnesses. And it felt, because of that, it didn't have the flash of the new that The Arbor had. Having said that, it's a deeply moving and provocative film.
Yeah, what I like about it is that a music, Karen Morley sort of described it as a bit of a musical in a way, because as we mentioned, Joyce Vincent, the woman at its centre, really wanted to be a musician in some kind of way. There's a Spotify playlist on the Dogwoof, who are distributing this film, on their website. There's a Spotify playlist of all the music that's in that film, which I think is a very smart bit of social networking, odd kind of, you know, confluence of social networking, which keeps people in touch about a film about someone who'd completely fallen out of touch.
Well, I guess that's appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your number three then, Dan?
My number three is a film from Iran called A Separation.
یکیش پدرم. من پدرم رو نمیتونم ول کنم. بازم بگم؟
ولی زن تو میتونی ول کنی.
من کی تو رو ول کردم؟ تو منو کشوندی دادگاه.
تو
برای من دادخواست طلاق فرستادی من کشوندی اینجا زندگی برای
A Separation is, as the title might clue you in, a tale of divorce. It's a middle-class couple who are divorcing. She wants to leave Iran and go somewhere that's more friendly to women and to women's aspirations. She has an 11-year-old daughter. She wants out. He is caring for his father, who has Alzheimer's and wants to stay. So by circumstance, they're split. And it's one of those films that it's, you know, the personal is the political.
Yeah, this
and
is a film about Tehran, although it doesn't feel like we've seen many films like this about. There's normally some kind of allegorical thing, people walking
around
in bales yelling.
It's rural.
Yeah.
I mean, most Iranian films are rural, and this is very much sort of steeped in the city and what we would consider the middle class. But it's a Tehran that's nonetheless riven by class and by gender. And it's about... It's sort of Rashomon-esque almost. It's we have sympathy for both of their standpoints, and the truth is up for grabs, really. And it's about the terrible damage that people can wreak on each other.
On BBC Four this year, they've been playing a dramatization of that kind of novel of the moment, The Slap, about the reverberations of a kind of middle class act of violence. Roman Polanski's film Carnage is out next year, about a playground fight between two kids, the bourgeois fallout from that. A Separation sort of taps into that a bit as well, except you've got this extraordinary kind of extra pressure that religion plays.
That's the
here.
Thing, and the jeopardy is that much greater in this film. There's the imam who has a role, sort of, you know, making moral judgments on these people. You've got particularly the housemaid who's hired, who won't wash the father because, you know, he's naked, and so consults the imam. And you just have the sense of betrayal. The terrible betrayal that can happen within families and within social groups, perhaps for decent intentions, but the way it all goes wrong is... It grips like a vice, this film, and I thought it was superb.
The winner of the Golden Bear at Berlin earlier this year. So we've got some strong films that won those festivals as well. The first Iranian winner of that. It's good to see it's been recognised at the London Film Critics Circle, and you know, people are sort of coming to this film. I saw it. It's not in my top 10, and I sort of feel a bit bad about it, but I'm very adamant that it isn't. For some reason, it didn't. Whilst I was completely gripped by what was going on, it's almost... what it reminded me of actually was Hidden, the Michael Kaneker film.
Yes, absolutely.
It had that, and which I don't want to. If there's a spoiler, if you don't like spoilers, kind of look away now. The film is a bit open ended in its end, which I think is both its kind of slightly. It's a slightly weak point, but it's also its strong point. I mean, that's Hidden is open ended as well in a kind of famous locked off shot.
Yeah, I guess the film stands or falls by whether you think that the hidden ending is fitting and the right way to send it off, or whether it's an abdication. And I thought it was the perfect way to send it off, because you're spending most of the film thinking which one of these people has my moral backing. And you're left still with that coming out.
It's a film I am going to revisit in 2012 ahead of the award season, but it didn't make my list, but I do think it's a very, very strong choice, and certainly an extraordinary thing from Iran, as you say, not seen before, a film of this sophistication. And depth of screenplay and performances as well. A Separation by Asghar Farhadi. Now, we're getting to the nub of things. The top two of our countdown this year. Zan, at number two, what is yours?
My number two film of the year is currently, I'm happy to report, the Oscar favourite for next year, which maybe makes me very... It's creeping conservatism coming in. But nonetheless, I thought that this was a beautiful film. It's The Artist by Michel Hazanavicius.
Well, in the manner of The Artist, I have a silent response to that, Zan. So let's just not talk about that for the moment.
Right.
We will talk about it, don't worry.
I think you're giving quite a lot away.
A little bit there. Because my number two is something you've mentioned before. I'm going for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy at number two, which you mentioned, I think, earlier at your number five. And I put it right up there as my number two. And I think always from the start, we both saw this prior to Venice this year. And it's a film that I wanted to champion. I think it's a beautifully, beautifully tailor-made piece about British life in a way. I know it's John le Carré, I know it's spying, but in a way we've got an underground Oxbridge here. We've got a class system all of itself set in the bowels, the bunker of the circus in 1970s, directed by Thomas Alfredson and featuring Gary Oldman as George Smiley here, finding out that all is not well at the top of the circus.
He said there's a mole right at the top of the circus that he's been there for years. It does mean you're rather well placed to look into this matter for us now, doesn't it? Outside the family.
I'm retired, Oliver. You fired me.
The thing is, some time ago before Control died, he came to me with a similar suggestion. That there is a mole.
I loved Gary Oldman as George Smiley, but it's also an ensemble piece as well. I mean, I kind of loved everyone in it, and almost everything in
it. It's, I suppose this is the cure for the modern espionage thriller, isn't it? In that it's stealthy and deliberate and almost recessive at times. And by its nature, this is a game played out in the shadows, and its protagonists aren't the James Bond or the Bourne figures. They're these jumpy little ulcerous men with, you know, thick glasses and thinning hair, wandering around this rabbit warren of offices.
Yeah, it's more depressive than
it's totally depressive. Yeah, and it's this great depressive sense of 1970s London that looks like a foreign country. It looks like a foreign planet. It's not the London that we know now. It's wimpy bars and smoke-filled offices and filing cabinets.
It's also not the London of the 70s that we know through kind of, I don't know, Supergrass videos.
Yeah, it's not Bieber and Carnaby
Jimmy
Street.
Seville and all of that. No. There was this where some of London might have been acrylics, but most of it was still 1950s.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? And all those, the post-war fashion. So it's a great sense of that knackered world, and it's a sense of the dog days of the Cold War, where these people are exhausted by what they're fighting for. They've almost kind of forgotten what it is and what the polarities are, and that the colour has all been drained out of them and everything looks much the same. And there's a great scene where, you know, it's the, you know, a seasonal choice here, the worst office Christmas party you could ever imagine. And then in the middle of this, Santa Claus comes on, but he's wearing a Lenin mask. And there's this sense that everybody's wearing masks, but they've forgotten why they're wearing them and what's behind it even.
You're talking this film up your own list, I think. I mean, it's getting
this could have, in another year, this would have been my number one, I think. And I saw it again, and it was better the second time. I think it's a film of such subtle layers that you almost don't appreciate just how fiendishly well constructed it is until you see it the second time.
I too had to. That's why I'm kind of so high on my list of films of the year, because for me it sort of dominated the back end of the year. So I had to see it again and check whether the layers were there, whether production design was so smart all the time, whether that wonderful, again, it's not a spoiler, but the final scene, which is set to a very rare piece
under the
sea, but done by Julio Iglesias in French live at Olympia, and it's just the weirdest choice that kind of works in this, and really it's almost like a 7-minute sequence where all things get sorted out and plots come together, and it's an extremely daring way of telling it that is completely counter-espionage cliche done by Thomas Alfredson. I mean, I love that. I mean, people have said to me, oh, it doesn't quite come together, it doesn't quite thrill, and I guess, but that's Le Carré as well. That's why Le Carré's never been as popular as Bond, for example, but it's almost a literary piece, this film. It's a great read, this film, and I enjoy it thoroughly. thoroughly each time I see it, and I sort of can't wait to see it again as it becomes a classic.
And significantly, it was a bit of a box office hit here, wasn't it?
Here it
I remember
was, yeah.
watching it thinking, this is so good, but it's a hard sell. And people seem to have gone in large numbers to see this, which gives me a little hope.
It does, and I hope for their sequel. I hope Gary Oldman reprises George Smiley, yeah. And there is talk already of Smiley's People, the movie, coming again. So that's my number two. You've chosen the artist, so we're going to arrive at number one. And my silence, as you said, spoke volumes, because my number one film of 2011 is The Artist. See, you thought it was silent, but there is lovely music. Ludwig Mors's music, who we saw at the European Film Academy, you and I, collecting best score for his film The Artist. I've chosen this because I love it. And yeah. It's very rare that I can get to say that I absolutely love a film. And I think that's...
Yeah, there's no qualifications, is it? It's absolute just falling head over heels
for
a film. Yeah,
this is kind of why I like movies. Yeah. This is why we all like movies. We like the image. It's a film that completely took me up by surprise at Cannes. I didn't know what it was going to be, a silent black and white French movie. It's enchanted me ever since. It's sort of dominated my film going life this year. I've seen it three times. I sort of interviewed Bérénice Bejo at Cannes because she's gorgeous. Interviewed her again in London recently. I've interviewed Michel Agenovicius on the podcast last week. I hung out with them in Berlin at the European Film Awards. It's become a sort of, you know, somehow entwined with my own life.
You've been dancing with them.
I've been dancing, tap dancing along with them. I'm probably more like Uggy the dog than anything else in this film. If you haven't seen it yet, it's out in 2 days' time on the 30th of December. I think it's a film that will go on to win the Best Picture Oscar and become the first silent movie for 80 years to do so. Is it just a pastiche, though, Zan? Am I succumbing to something that is little more and featherweight?
That was my worry about it, that it would be just expert pastiche, and it's not. It's a film that gives nostalgia a good name, I think, because it's like reconnecting with something, with a language that we thought had gone and had been lost, and finding it just as vibrant and beautiful and moving as it was back in the heyday. It's a film about the decline and fall of the silent screen era, with Jean Dujardin as the sort of fading star. But it follows the rules of silent film, but then breaks from them very significantly. It can be the clink of a glass on the dressing table, or this wonderful moment as well where his shadow walks off screen and defies him. And it's got some blackness in here. It's got some proper darkness among all of the intoxicating choreography too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I thought this was a beautiful, heartfelt film.
Yeah, me too. And it got me every time. It springs into joy, and you walk out humming the tune.
It's the joy. I mean, on the most basic level, there is something joyous about just watching people dance. There's something so uplifting about that. And, you know, you can put all the sophistication on the back shelf.
Enjoying watching some people dance. I've got a feeling you and Matt Patz would
maybe
not be
skipping maybe not,
out
but,
the room.
But these two, I could just watch the film with them dance.
I remember writing in Cannes that were the artist to win at Cannes, it would be the light-heartedest film to win at Cannes ever. The only one musical ever has, All That Jazz by Bob Fosse. That's kind of a sort of notoriously dark musical. It was beaten at Cannes by another film, which I think might be your number one.
It is my number one. And again, absolutely unequivocally. And again, love. I mean, pure and simple love for Terrence Malick's film, The Tree of Life.
Who do you love most?
I love you all three the same.
Tell us a story from before we can remember.
Went for a ride in a plane once. Graduation present.
There we go. It's been sweeping the Palme d'Or. Was the first tree of life that the Tree of Life won. Terrence Malick's return, as always, to a kind of the most anticipated film event of the year. You know, in a way, you're right. It is a film of the year, because it could have been a film of last year, but wasn't.
Yeah.
Got here eventually. And you were swept up in it.
Yeah, I think this was the film that most affected me, that I watched. I came out almost sort of levitating, almost sort of trembling.
Well, she does that. Jessica Chastain levitates in that film.
But everyone levitates in this film, basically. It's a... It's a transcendental film.
What
it's
was it that got you so much? Because, I mean, I'm there too. I loved much of it, I have to say. But it's a tale of small-town life in 1950s. Brad Pitt as the,
yes,
as
it
the
is.
Father and
it's,
kids growing up. That's not your life.
It's not my life, but it felt like my life for the few hours that I was watching it. It's a film that gives us the microcosm and the macrocosm, I guess, that it justifies its totally hubristic birth of the cosmos sequence and then the dinosaurs coming by being so rooted in the specifics of life and this family in, you know, the twilight suburbs of Waco, Texas, and the fact that childhood can be an Eden and then it's torn down and you've got this fantastic performance from Brad Pitt as the sort of ramrod straight dad who wants to be somebody but can't be. He says at one point, you know, he didn't notice the glory. His failing was he didn't notice the glory. And this film notices the glory. It notices the glory of everything, whether it's, you know, a discarded shoe or the heavens opening.
It puts the two together, the wanting success and the glory of nature or life itself, the way of nature, the way of grace, says Jessica Chastain's character. Did you never at any point find the philosophy of it slightly trite? I know I'm attacking Terrence Malick.
I think
one
a lot of
great
people
thinkers.
Are saying that.
I did. I didn't come out levitating because I didn't really learn anything. Even though I don't really want to go to learn anything, like, you know, like
I'm not sure
Seinfeld
that it
character.
Even has a philosophy. Maybe you could say that the final scene on the beach is a bit of a placebo.
It kind of let me down that
at
one.
The end. If I'm picking holes in it, you know, maybe there are too many shots of Sean Penn wandering around the office complex, you know, with a face like
yeah,
a wet weekend.
It looked
weekend.
Like he was looking for a Starbucks and couldn't quite
yeah,
find
I think
it.
He
maybe
did.
We all are.
I think he did, but it's still, it's a film about, you know, the human condition and how we feel. On the one hand, the paradoxical thing of being human, of being, on the one hand, feeling utterly insignificant and at the same time being the star of your drama and thinking that the heavens do revolve us around us and that the death of a loved one is the most cataclysmic thing. And it is like the stars exploding. And that captured that. It made me, I think, kind of almost well up twice, this film. One scene where the mother is dressing the baby's foot and just that kind of intimacy. And then the other scene where the son, who we learn will later die, is playing the guitar while Brad Pitt is playing the piano. And he looks at him with kind of thunder, but then also with total love. And there's a rivalry there. And it has those epiphany moments of total intimacy that I think justifies the broad canvas that it's slapped down on.
It's very interesting that both of us have gone for a number one that I think they are both unique occurrences. I've never seen anything like The Tree of Life. I've never seen anything like The Artist, or certainly not since 1927.
Right.
So
can you remember back that far?
Yeah, I know where I
You're
exactly
in
where
trousers,
I was.
Then.
You know, well, I agree. Terrence Malick can do the mother of all flashbacks to the dinosaurs and volcano. I can certainly get back to 27. The Tree of Life. I did enjoy it, and I do enjoy it. And again, I've puzzled over it more than any other film this year. It didn't make my top 10. It is sort of in. It's not even in my top 25, really.
Really,
I don't know, but I don't know where it is.
You've fallen a bit more out of love with it since Cannes.
It's here. It's there. It's everywhere for me. It's sort of just. It's almost kind of. I don't know to restrain it in the sort of base metal of the top 10 is not fair.
That was the debate in Cannes when this played, and some people hated it, and some people loved it, and there was almost an unspoken acknowledgement that it was either going to win the Palme d'Or or it was going to get nothing. Because to give it the Best Director prize or in certain, you know, one of the other prizes would have been ridiculous. That it's so vast that either you can't look at it. It's like God. Either just deny that he's there or embrace him.
I cannot think of a more kind of existential note nor festive note on which to end. So, Zan Brooks, thank you for your review of the year and your choice of The Tree of Life, which has me wafting once more. It is all for this week and for this year. Thanks to my brother in crime, Zan Brooks. We got closer through our top tens, as we can nearly see.
At one stage, we were almost wearing the same trousers.
Like a snowman walking through the air hand in hand together. It's been a great 2011. All I can hope for is that it's as strong in 2012 as it was this year. We've got awards season to get through, so I guess many of our choices in this show will be hopefully reflected in the awards bodies to come in 2012. A huge thanks to all of you, of course, for listening throughout the year, and to our many fantastic guests that we've had on this show, from people in The Tree of Life to the people in The Artist. We do pick the best for you on Film Weekly. From me, Jason Solomons, from Zan Brooks, and our producer throughout the year, Jason Phipps, we wish you a very happy and healthy cinematic 2012. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.